This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/artofman. That's lynda.com/artofman for a free 10-day trial. And make sure to tweet me and let me know the course that you're taking. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So if you've been reading the site for a while, you've probably seen some content written by a guy named Kyle Eschenroeder. He's a business owner, owns a company called Startup Bros, where he and his partner train individuals how to start their own online business. But besides being an entrepreneur, Kyle reads deeply and he thinks deeply about a lot of important topics on how to live the good life. The two pieces of content that he's written for The Art of Manliness that have resonated with a lot of readers was the first one is about the myths of taking action. It's about the excuses we give or tell ourselves that prevent us from taking action we know we need to take. And the other one was on how to thrive in uncertainty. It's taking on this idea that in modern life, we've deluded ourselves into thinking that we have more control over our lives than we think we do. And we have this, there's an app for that mentality, right? With a click of a button, you can solve any problem. The reality is there are some things in life that we just have no control over. And the trick is figuring out how to create a life that not only can survive that uncertainty, but can thrive in it. And that's what that article talks about. And I brought Kyle on to the podcast because I want to discuss these topics in detail and get really deep into it. So that's what we're going to do today. Really great conversation. I think you're going to like it. So without further ado, Kyle Eschenroeder on thriving in uncertainty. Kyle Eschenroeder, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brett. I'm looking forward to it.
So you've contributed some articles on our site that have really impacted a lot of people. We get emails about them all the time. And we're going to talk about some of the themes you've written about in these articles. I'd like to really have this discussion with you. But before we do, let's talk about your background because it's really interesting and pretty unconventional. Can you tell us how you became this philosopher entrepreneur guy that you are?
Oh man, I've always read deeply. I think I started day trading under a mentor in high school, and in order to do that, it's very emotionally trying. So getting into meditation and philosophy is kind of a natural progression for anybody who does that. I went to college and continued to trade and started to dabble in startups. I got involved with GrooveShark.com early on and really was excited by the potential in value creation that you can a startup can have. And so it seemed to me one of the best ideas, you know, these ideas that I was studying as an extension of trading, you could really have a bigger effect in the real world through startups. So that's where the kind of entrepreneurial part came in. And really, you know, early on it was more self-development focused stuff and, you know, self-help stuff. And I think, you know, if you read enough of that, you start to question their premises and realize that they haven't really, you know, and I say they broadly, but you need to look at, you know, maybe why you're doing something or what's at the core of this, what need is this fulfilling, and that is kind of where you get down into more, I guess, intense philosophies.
So is that what got you into researching and studying and writing about philosophy, just trying to find some balance to the uncertainty that you find in startup culture and day trading? Is that what it was?
Yeah, I think it's a great balancer, but also a driver. You know, if you're just going to be an entrepreneur and that's the only thing you're focused on, you'll still create value, but you don't have as solid of a foundation or perspective on what you're building, the society that you're building it in, and how you can kind of do the most good.
All right, so you can read these personal development books, right? And a lot of people do. I do. They're often very practical, and there's always the bullet point list of things you can do right now to apply to your own life or to your own business. But how does studying things like the uncertainty principle or Nietzsche or Seneca, how has that made you a better businessman in your day-to-day, I'm talking practical brass tacks level?
Mm-hmm. So I think these things give you a great grounding in dealing with people and in dealing with struggle, gaining perspective. So you know, honestly, Brett, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs who don't read a lot, who don't have a strong foundation in Nietzsche, who are much better entrepreneurs than me. You know, I think of Steve Jobs, I think of John Rockefeller. These guys are famous for reading very little. I mean, Carnegie barely read. And so I think the difference that it depends on what you're doing. So in the businesses that I've been involved in, I deal with people a lot. And for me, it's very important to have an understanding of where I'm headed. So, you know, every day I can, you know, communicate to people more directly, kind of the vision and how we sit as a company in the community, in our society today, the good that we're doing, maybe more fully than somebody who hasn't read as widely. But I do hesitate to say that, you know, as far as an entrepreneur creating ROI, I don't know that it has a direct impact.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I love how you, as a businessman, you're thinking of the bigger picture. Oftentimes, there's this cult of the startup and internet businesses where it's just about making enough money for yourself so you can live the dream, travel, be location independent, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
My question is, how do you get past that where there's this filter bubble where everyone's just talking about, okay, here's what's about me. Here's what I can do for me. How do you see startup cultures and businesses taking on a bigger approach and actually having an effect on the community around them?
That's really interesting. That's a really interesting question. I think it may be a natural cycle, that's kind of what I'm hoping on, is that this kind of obsession with location independent entrepreneur is almost wearing itself out, exhausting itself, because there's so many people who have accomplished that now, who are, you know, they're empty. They realize that this is not the best way. They realize it's not as easy as, you know, 4 hours a week. It takes full-time commitment. You take on massive responsibilities. And also, you know, once you hit a certain level, you realize that the only way that you can be fulfilled is by helping other people truly, not in a the kind of empty way that many of these businesses go about it. And honestly, Brett, I mean, if you look around at the businesses that sustain themselves, very few of those kind of, you know, get a business up and running so I can create passive income and then forget about it and go, you know, live my life in, I don't know, Hawaii or whatever. I've watched a lot of them, this whole kind of group of people just put, throw stuff up and fizzle out immediately. The only people that have staying power to be true entrepreneurs are ones that do want to create something that's bigger than just them. As much as we want to talk about it, as much as entrepreneurship can be broken down into steps or, you know, made you know, systematized, it's always hard. Business is one of the most abstract things you can do. It's extremely difficult to create something lasting. Unless people have that kind of drive to do something bigger than themselves, it's not going to last. And so I guess my answer to you is I think it's taking care of itself.
Nice. Sort of like natural selection.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That brought up an interesting point. One of the things I find about people who are into entrepreneurship and startups, they love starting things. You know, they get really excited about starting new projects. And I have some acquaintance who call themselves serial entrepreneurs. You know, they're all, because they're always starting something new. And it's always exciting to start something new. But if you're that type of person who loves to start things, how do you make the transition to, okay, I started something. It's gaining momentum. It's got some teeth. How do you transition to managing and maintaining that business for the long haul?
Yeah, and so that's where you have kind of two options. And this happens at every level, from people starting, you know, blogs to people starting multi, you know, companies that end up being valued at billions of dollars. There comes a point when you decide to become a manager or to leave the business. So this, you know, once you develop a business, this has happened with Startup Bros, the company that I started with my friend Will. It has gotten to the point after a couple of years that it's taken on a life of itself, its own. We're no longer a startup. We're now managers. We're now managing growth. We're now feeding this separate thing that has its own life now, and there's less freedom in it. It's a completely different mode, and so you have to either decide whether you want to switch modes, whether you want to become a manager and deal with the grind, or if you want to go look for, you know, the next startup opportunity. And like I said, you know, a lot of startups in Silicon Valley, investors pressure these startup CEOs at a certain point to either they need to leave or get trained in, you know, serious management, and it's not a transition everybody can or wants to make.
Yeah, maybe this is just me. I feel like with this whole startup culture where startups are really sexy, it's fun, you get the Nerf guns at lunch and you get food catered in, I feel like management part, right, gets de-emphasized. People who, their talent is telling people how to do things efficiently and getting things done and maintaining the momentum that a startup person has started. They're sort of like the unsexy dork at the dance who hides in the corner. But those people have incredible value.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're pointing out something that I like to call kind of, the sexy tax that you pay. If you want to do the thing that's being celebrated by culture, you have to deal with generally decreased returns and increased competition. And so, you know, there's, you know, startup culture, it only celebrates like a very few young billionaires. Or you know, or then on the other side, it celebrates these like teenagers that are all starting businesses. And I've been involved in these startup shows, there's, you know, we actually get approached by these television studios, these production houses that are trying to launch startup, the real world. What are they called? You know, the real world of startups, basically, and everyone fails because the highlights are, like you said, it's the very beginning, it's the initial exciting ideas, and then it's like the IPO or when you sell to Facebook or Google, but everything in between is just agony. It's just sitting at a computer, typing, programming, desperately trying to sell your services. It's boring. And it's, like you said, it's not exciting. And so when people kind of have this Hollywood idea of what it is to be a startup entrepreneur, they act on these kind of abstract ideas that they have of what an entrepreneur should be, instead of actually focusing on what does my business need from me today? How do I build this thing into something real? How do I provide value? And those are kind of the boring questions that nobody's going to make a show on, but those are the things that actually grow businesses.
We're going to take a quick break for your word from our sponsors. All right, guys, if you're wanting to learn something new this year, maybe you want to learn a skill for your business, maybe you just want to learn a skill so you have a hobby to do, you need to check out lynda.com. They have over 3,000 on-demand video courses taught by experts in a wide variety of topics. You know, I've done the courses on photography, Photoshop, videography, productivity. That one's taught by David Allen, the guy who wrote Getting Things Done. Right now, I almost finished the course on Excel spreadsheets, and I've become a Excel ninja, I would say. anyways, what's great about it, you can do the course at your own pace. There's no schedule. You can check in anytime you want, watch it on your tablet, your smartphone, your desktop. They got transcripts of all the videos so you can read along as well. If you want to try lynda.com out free for 10 days, got an offer for you. Go to lynda.com/artofman for a free 10-day trial. Again, that's lynda.com/artofman, art of man. Check it out. Yeah, I've encountered this paradox or this problem in my own life. So in my backyard, I have some land. So I decided to build a trail through it. It was really, really fun blazing the trail. I have this awesome machete that I was cutting through all the weeds, the thistles and the thorns. And it was great to see my progress. Then winter came and I didn't go out there. Then I came back in the middle of the spring and it was all overgrown. And I was like, crap, I've got to maintain this thing now. And maintaining it is not fun at all.
Right. And that's what you have to do for decades. It takes, a year to build the thing, and that's exciting. You get to see progress. And then the rest is just fighting off decay, entropy.
Yeah. And this just isn't something that applies to business, but also applies to someone with their personal development. You know, it's always fun to start a new goal. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to start journal writing. I'm going to be awesome. Then you get into the grind, and you've got to keep doing it.
And right, and that's where the payoffs only come after that grind, after that getting through that super boring plateau where you get to the next peak or whatever.
Yeah, let's talk about one of the articles you wrote for us last year. Today, we still get emails and letters about it. It was 10 overlooked truths about taking action. And a lot of people talk about taking action on the web. Deeds, not words, carpe diem, take action, blah, blah, blah.
As they write that on their Facebook profile.
Yeah, exactly. But people still have a hard time taking action on their intentions, their goals, their dreams. I mean, why is that? Why is it so hard? I mean, you feel really motivated at the beginning of the day, but taking that motivation, actually turning it into action is really hard for folks.
Yeah. And that's the tough question that, that I can't really answer. And I don't think anybody really can or maybe even should. So, I mean, there's an infinite amount of good reasons probably, not to, good rationalizations. One of the most interesting ones I came across recently came from Mark Manson. He calls it the Manson principle, that we don't do things that threaten our personal identity, even if it would, make us better. And so we kind of have this homeostasis, to use a term from Ludwig Sundström, that sticks us where we're at. There's an infinite amount of forces hitting us from different directions. And so I think my suggestion, and kind of what the article is attempting to do, is to trick us out of, pointing out these reasons and tricking ourselves to take action anyway. So Freudian or what are they, psychoanalysts have had a pretty terrible success rate in fixing people because they're so obsessed with finding these hidden causes. And a lot of times it might be more helpful just to forget about them, not worry about them, and so that's where I kind of think we should try to trick ourselves into taking action, even though it feels like there might be reasons not to.
So, what are some myths that people have about action?
Yes, yeah, and I think one of the most interesting ones to notice is that people believe things like motivation, passion, purpose, courage, reasons, justifications, or even planning always must precede action, when in fact all these things more naturally follow action. And once you can kind of, it's very, very difficult to believe because we're so wired to believe the opposite. But once we can wrap our heads around that, and once we prove that to ourselves, it becomes extremely easy to take those actions that we know we should.
Yeah. You see that again and again on the internet. Everyone is always talking about you've got to follow your passion, find your passion. you know, people even put up the memes on their Facebook profile or Tumblr, or, you know, they got their totem animal where it says, I'm the gym beast. I'm going to be awesome. Then they don't do anything. They don't go to the gym.
Right. Yeah. And I know if you've not noticed this, it tends to be the most out of shape people who know the most about fitness, who know the most about exactly what exercises to do to get X results. They tend to have this extreme book knowledge, but then just forgot that kind of vital part that means, you know, go to the gym.
Right. Go to the gym and get started.
Yeah.
So you see this not just in business, but with their personal development. People have these goals and they feel like, if I want to lose weight, I've got to get motivated. And once I get motivated and I feel like it, then maybe it's going to be a breeze. But that's not how it works.
Right. And you know, I need to get motivated. And I need the perfect plan. You know, once I have just this perfect plan and the perfect outfit and the perfect gym partner or whatever, then I'll do it. But it never happens, you know. And any of those people who get, if they have a friend that's good enough to drag them to the gym for, you know, a week consistently, those people are motivated. They now, all those abstract barriers to entry have been deleted, and they understand that it just means going to the gym and sweating.
Yeah, Stephen King is a great example of just doing it. I mean, you don't have to be motivated. You don't have to have the perfect everything. He just wrote. When he wrote Carrie, he was living in a really small house, and he would just write on the kitchen table in the corner while his wife was banging pots and pans in the kitchen, and it didn't matter. He wrote the book. And a lot of people think, well, if I'm going to start a business or write this blog post, I need to do my ritual. And here's my little thing that I got to have, and it's got to be perfectly set up, and I have to have my headphones and my background music and my binaural beats, and then the motivation and the inspiration will just come.
Yeah, that is, yeah, it's just so ridiculous. And you know, I think one of the things that tricks us into this is like this endless supply of clickbait that says this will maximize your productivity and this will maximize your productivity. And if if you're going to be a writer, you need your walls painted this color. And really, when you look at anybody, like I have this book called Daily Rituals. It's like a couple hundred people that are, you know, these artists and just high achievers in many different creative areas. And every one of them have different rituals, and they were all developed over time as people found out their own personal needs. And so, you know, every writer who is it will tell you that you don't sit down and just know exactly what you're going to say. You sit down and you try really hard to say something. It usually comes out terribly. Then you have to go back and edit it. You know, it's very messy. It's very messy. We're so hungry for answers. People feed us answers, and then we paralyze ourselves when we can't kind of set up this perfect instance. When in reality, it's the equivalent of going to the gym and sweating, just sitting down writing garbage until something golden comes out.
All right. So there's also this big emphasis on goals, and I'm a big fan of setting goals for myself. But how can goals get in the way of taking action?
Yeah, and so I do, you know, before we get into that, I want to say that goals work really well for a lot of people. I know a lot of people who have a lot of success with goals. For me, they haven't done, they didn't work as well. And I think a lot of people get stuck with goals because they rely on a kind of fantasy future and deny the present moment. So every day you go to the gym and you're still chubby, you're failing, you know, because your goal is to be ripped or to be, you know, X pounds. So every day that you go, it's not motivating to know that you're behind schedule. And then when you do hit that goal, when you do get ripped, let's say, you have to immediately set a new goal that you're then failing at and start to achieve that one. So say maybe it's bulking, you know, and in the gym. So it's always just kind of you're set up for disappointment and failure. And so A fix for this was actually suggested by the author of Dilbert, the Dilbert comics, Douglas Adams. Or not Douglas Adams, I'm sorry, Scott Adams. But yeah, he suggests setting up a system. So if you want to, if you're, you know, you have this general aim to get ripped, instead of saying I'm going to have 4% body fat by the end of 2 months, you say I'm going to go to the gym for 1 hour every day, 4 days a week. So you set up a system, and every time you implement that system, you're succeeding. And so you spend the whole time that you're on the right track winning. And like we were talking about action before, that then shocks you into appreciating the actions being taken instead of just the results, obsessing on this kind of abstract outcomes of actions taken now.
So process-oriented as opposed to results-oriented.
Right.
Right, right. Now, one thing you mentioned, planning, is that planning can get in the way of taking action. But shouldn't it play some role in your business or in your personal life? I mean, what role does planning and deep reflection fit into this ideal of action?
Right. And Brett, I'm glad you brought this up, because that's one thing that the article really didn't deal with, and that it's difficult to talk about when you want to balance two ideas.
Sure.
So the goal of the article was, you know, there's 10 overlooked truths about taking action. And so the reason I wanted to really dig into helping us understand what action is, so that we can put it into a more healthy context. And then a lot of people kind of mistook that as I should always be taking action. Thinking is terrible. Planning ahead, terrible. Obviously, that's just not the case. So my suggestion is to, there's no one size fits all. So you know, if you're planning out a trip to Mars, if you're Elon Musk's team planning out a trip to Mars, you need every detail exactly right, because there's going to be very little improvisation you can do from Earth to help that mission out. You know what I mean? But on the other end is, we were just talking about the gym, going to the gym. You don't need any plan to get in a better shape than you are today. So yes, reading a fitness book might be helpful, and creating a plan might help you stay consistent. But going today, doing that thing now, is going to kind of invigorate the plan that you do create, and give you better context for it. So the business version of this is the lean startup methodology. And this is especially true of software companies, not companies with, complex supply chains and require huge investment up front. But you basically, you create an MVP, which is a minimum viable product. What is the smallest thing that we can create to test this assumption that we're making about our business? And then you plan minimally, and then you take action. And then that allows you to take advantage of both sides of the coin. So you get all the advantages of taking action, like watching new opportunities emerge, watching unforeseen problems pop up, without as large of an initial investment. But at the same time, you have this minimal plan that is driving you in the right direction.
So it depends on the context, right?
Yes, yes. And I would say, and for all of us in our individual lives, it's always less than you think. It's always, less. You need to read less books than you think. You need to read less blogs than you think. When you're risking very little, you need very little planning.
Got you. Now, one reason that a lot of people don't take action, and you wrote about this, is uncertainty. They're surrounded by uncertainty. They don't want to make that investment in the business because they don't know if it'll be a success, or, who knows how the economy will change. With our ever-changing modern world, things are just speeding up because of technology. Things are unstable and always changing. So how should we manage our life and career in the face of such uncertainty?
Yeah, I think one thing that is extremely helpful to do initially, and this just helps you emotionally deal with uncertainty, is to differentiate between the uncertainty that you feel versus the uncertainty that actually exists. So you don't have to feel uncertain about a situation just because that situation isn't 100% likely to happen. So once you differentiate between those two things, it makes everything else a little bit easier. And Brett, yeah, I know you're a fan of Stoicism, and the Stoics recommend one really interesting tool for dealing with uncertainty, and that is the triad of control. So as you go through life, you can separate situations or events into three parts. They're either in your control, out of your control, or partly in your control. So something that's in your control is the effort you put into something. Something that's outside of your control would be, you know, is the company you work for going to stay in business? And then a mix would be like you getting the job or getting into that school or having success with this business, because you can put in everything and that kind of tips the odds in your favor, but it may not absolutely get you there. So once you've separated things out like that, you can then totally focus on and do your best to tie your emotions to things that are in your control. So, and that goes back to the systems. If you tie your emotional life to completing your system successfully that day, then you are you're more likely to have the grit that's needed to get through possible failures and stuff like that.
So besides the emotional resilience, and I think that's really important in the face of uncertainty, but what do you do about it on an operational level or tactical level, I guess? What can you do to manage the uncertainty so you're not on the bad end of it, you know, so you can adapt?
Absolutely, yeah. And so you wrote a great post on this too, based on Taleb, the Beyond Sissy Resilience, I believe. And there's two big ways that you can expose yourself to the upside. That is, you don't know what's going to happen, but you're setting yourself up to take advantage of something crazy happening, because you know that in the future there are going to be kind of wild shifts, especially now that's increasing with the increasing rate of technology, like you mentioned. So the first way to do that is to increase your optionality. So that means give yourself more options to select from, so when the time comes, you can make the best, most advantageous choice. Examples of this would be having savings in the bank. So, you know, if a business opportunity comes or investment opportunity comes, maybe you can jump on that. Going to parties that you might not want to go to, just because you are then exposed to interesting people who might be able to affect your life in a positive way. Learning new skills that could be useful in the future. And then also just, I really don't like talking about perspectives, but shifting your perspective to be open to the opportunities that come up, that increases your optionalities like crazy. Because if you're just focused on, you know, what you believe to be worthwhile today, you're going to be blind to, you know, what might be the next big thing or this wave that you're sitting on that you don't even realize it. So just shifting your perspective to noticing new options. And then another way that we can take advantage of this uncertainty instead of kind of having it bear down on us is making small bets or making small experiments. So an example of this is like the MVP that we talked about. This is how startups take advantage of this uncertainty. Investors know for in general, they don't know what startup is going to be the next Facebook, the next Google. And so they have to invest in many different businesses. And they like to see a business that that does believe that they know what's right, what the future looks like. But then they also want to be able to see that a business can pivot. So if their business model is disproven, they should be able to create something new, create something that based on what they learned from their failure will then help them win. So, and then, you know, in our everyday life, kind of, you know, if you're looking for a girlfriend, making small bets is talking to multiple girls at the same time. You know, for our blog at Startup Bros, when we decide what kind of program that we want to put together next, the training program, we use blog posts to gauge the demand for that type of project. So we make small bets to know what we should double down on.
Right, going back to optionality, I think a lot of people, particularly young people, misinterpret this as keeping your options open. And what ends up happening is that they don't make a decision. They have all these different choices and they don't actually take one because they still want the options available for them at some time when something doesn't pan out. They want to maximize their choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you balance? How do you maintain optionality while still getting going in life and making decisions and making progress?
Oof, that's a good question. I think that it's appreciating that the world is not totally uncertain. And so it's not like the goal of life isn't optionality. It's not just about having options open because the things that you decide on, that's where there's depth. So optionality is kind of your width, but it's important to have depth. So that's, I think that kind of model might be helpful. That's how I think about it. But it is, it's difficult to measure. I think, necessity, forces people into that depth. You know, so you see, you know, you talk about young people, it's young people that aren't forced into, having to create something now. They're kind of, honestly, they're trying to hack their way to this place of like you said, not deciding, of not committing. Optionality is not commitment. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's the best I got.
Got you. All right. So speaking of hacking, the most recent article you wrote for us was called Stop Hacking Your Life, and it went after the whole hacking culture, and we're not talking about computer hacking, we're talking about life hacks. And I feel like that's one of those things that's eating itself and it's slowly going away to a certain extent, but you make the case that there are two approaches to life hacking. What are they, and how can one of them be detrimental to our development?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about it eating itself up. I think there's two kind of relationships or postures that we have towards hacking. So you're either hacking, you know, in order to achieve an aim or to get a certain outcome. So that means you're, you know, when you go to look up the best way to tie a tie, you do that when you need to tie a tie. You have an awesome video on that, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
It focuses you on things that you're going to use now that are specific to your situation. You're optimizing for a specific outcome. And then the kind of unhealthy posture is hacking for hacking's sake, which is kind of this perverse meta hacking, and it's where hacking becomes the primary instead of the result that the hacking was supposed to get you. An example of this is, you know, scrolling through Life Hacker, just collecting articles on things that you probably don't do, you don't need to do, but they're like, they just blast you with this clickbait of, here's the answer to this question that you didn't know you had until just now. Here's like 100 ways that you'll never use to live a happier, better life. It ends up just, like you said, frustrating the user. And then they realize that their life actually doesn't get better because they're not, the goal is optimization itself. And when you optimize for, I like to look at it as a multiplier. So when you optimize for something, it multiplies on that number. But when you optimize for no reason or for life in general, which is impossible, you're optimizing for zero. And that is totally frustrating and ineffective.
Yeah. Have you read any G.K. Chesterton?
Oof. I've read one piece, and it was, I believe it was one of your Manvotationals.
Manvotionals. Yeah. Yeah. So he's this fierce critic of Nietzsche. His critiques are fascinating. They're really well-written. He's a great writer, super funny. And in one of his chapters in his book, Orthodoxy, he's a Christian writer. In Orthodoxy, he goes all over the place. But in this one part, he talks about when cultures or organizations start focusing on efficiencies, it means they've run out of big ideas.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's what happens particularly with business. They just focus on optimizing. We got to optimize our website so we can get more subscribers. We're going to increase our opt-in rate by 0.4%.
Right.
I'm like, what's your big idea? I mean, what else are you doing? I mean, at that point, you don't really have one. They're just trying to squeeze out as much as they can from this thing and they've already done. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, I guess. But at the same time, it distracts you from the bigger picture of trying to create something better and bigger than you had before.
Yeah, and I think one kind of illustration of what you just mentioned is Demand Media, which was basically, it's this like media company created by, I believe, the founders of MySpace, and it was all based on creating content based on big data. So they just, you know, would measure, you know, what is trending at all today, yada, 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 and then they create just very quickly, very crappily, create some piece of content that maps onto something that some big data system suggested, and it just is terrible. Nobody wants to read it because there's no soul. There's nothing there. I believe in that wholeheartedly. That's a tough balance because, you know, there's information that you do want to use. Like, you do want to make sure that you maximize conversions, but only to the point that you're not giving up what's truly valuable. And Brett, I gotta say, you, one reason I love Art of Manliness so much is because you, more than maybe anybody else in this, I don't know, quote unquote industry, has refused these kind of perverse incentives and kept data in its place.
Well, I appreciate that. And honestly, the reason I don't really pay much attention to it, because it bores me to tears.
Right.
Yeah. Hacking your life. How can it hurt you in the long run if that's all that you're focusing on and optimizing your life? I mean, it brings you short-term benefits for sure, but in the long run, are there detrimental effects?
Yeah, and they're very insidious, I would say, because like you said, because you get benefits up front and it feels like, oh my God, I'm optimizing my life, which means I'm optimizing literally everything I do. So this is this could never be a waste of time. When it's not only just a waste of time, it puts you in a bad posture towards life. In the article, I'll go through very quickly, but there's six ways that it kind of perverts your perspective, and that is one, that it assumes that effort is failure, because hacking is always trying to find the easiest way out. So its aim is at whatever means less effort, and then it forces you into bad decisions because it overvalues hype and undervalues the old and effective. So anybody who pays attention to fitness, I don't know. I honestly don't know how people still read new books that come out about nutrition, because it seems like every 6 months they negate what they said the time before. And 99% of us know very specific things that we could do to make ourselves more healthy. You know, be it going and exercising, or eating some more greens, or eating less ice cream, or like stop smoking. It doesn't matter how much organic stuff you eat if you're still smoking cigarettes. So Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner in investing, has this idea. He says, take a simple idea and take it seriously. And I think that would get us past a lot of hype. Another thing, it puts us in the posture of aimless optimization. So like I said, you know, when you optimize for zero, you're still left with zero. The hacking posture, it makes us constantly worried that we're using too much time. So we have this anxiety about literally, like if something takes an hour, we feel like it should have taken 20 minutes or something. Like if we knew just the right way to do it, we could have done it faster. Or we, you know, so, and that's what stops people from starting businesses, is they keep deluding themselves because people keep promising them ways that, you know, a painless way, a turnkey system to start a business. If there was truly a turnkey system, then that didn't require any personal effort, that company would just be a manufacturer of that type of company. It also makes you dependent on perfect circumstances. You mentioned Stephen King. If you're trying to hack your life, find the optimal environment to write in, you'll never start writing. And then finally, it favors irrational rationality. And actually, you know, you came off of this, you just wrote a great piece on Nietzsche, and you mentioned this in that piece, and I thought that was super interesting, that he feared, when he said God is dead, his true fear was that our sense of meaning was going to be destroyed because of this new obsession with science taking kind of God's place in a way. It absolutely has. You know, there's, depression is more prevalent than ever, because it's just, you know, we think that everything falls into rationality. We think that everything is explained by the material world, when it absolutely can't be. We need something. So the antidote to this is to, you know, dose yourself with rational irrationality. And Joseph Campbell, who's famous for the hero's journey, he even said that, you know, rational irrationality is essentially the key to becoming the modern hero. The modern hero is someone who can create meaning by caring for something more than it rationally or reasonably should be cared about. So I know I blew through those, but those are all ways that this kind of hacking posture can really mess us up.
That's awesome, awesome stuff. So there seems to be an underlying theme in all your writing and thinking. What do you think it is?
Oh man, and so you mentioned this. You made me do some soul searching. And honestly, I'm probably the least qualified person to answer this question. But my best idea is I'm kind of trying to continue the project of self-trust, or shocking ourselves into self-trust.
Self-trust. I like that. Now, you mentioned one of my favorite guys, Charlie Munger. He's really big on this idea of developing mental models in order to thrive and take action. And I love his idea, because mental models are just different ways of looking at the world. A mental model is can be a legal mental model, an economics mental model, biology can be a mental model. And you can take these different things and approach them to any problem in life and find insights, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there topics or areas of studies or disciplines that you think folks should focus on in order to build these mental models to help them be more effective managers, thrivers in the uncertain?
Yeah, that's you mentioned a couple of them. I mean, I think, you know, the big standards that Munger mentions are, you know, physics, biology, psychology, engineering, and history. You know, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg will tell you that programming is the essential model. And you know, I like to use philosophy a lot, as well as, you know, biology and economics specifically. But I think, you know, my recommendation to people is to respect your interests. So, you know, if that underlying theme is self-trust, then I say, you know, trust your interests to provide you with some of these powerful models, at least to start. You know, so you see athletes and even like big sports fans that use sports metaphors to get them through life, to make management decisions. Like big gamers that I know, they gamify everything in their life, and they make it so much easier and enjoyable just by imagining it as some kind of RPG or something. But then, you know, even fiction books or movies that people relate to, I think these stories provide really, really great foundational mental models, and just, you know, how to be in the world. Yeah, that's my advice is self-trust.
Last question. I'm always impressed whenever you submit articles to us, because you're always quoting and sourcing thinkers like Seneca, Nietzsche, Munger, I mean, all sorts of people. It's all over the place. And so obviously you're well-read. How do you read so much, and how do you keep track of what you've read?
So I read a lot of books because I think everybody reads a lot, but I just prioritize books over social media feeds, clickbait, and then like bad TV. I refuse to watch TV show unless it's like, you know, True Detective or Game of Thrones, basically. And that opens up an amazing amount of time. Like everybody reads so many books a year worth of words just in really bad clickbait. And I only read what I'm interested in, so it makes it very easy. Trusting those interests and following them makes it so it's fun to pick up the book, and it's not something I have to, you know, use willpower to do. And then I think you asked about tracking. Sorry.
Yeah. How do you keep track of all that stuff?
I really don't. I highlight all the books or have a type of highlighting system. And then books that I really, really care about, I put into Evernote. I type up all my notes. But that's very few. So generally when I'm writing, I just kind of remember the gist of some passage in a book, and I have to go find the book and open pages. It's just sift through to try to find it. And so it's huge, huge waste of time.
Yeah, that's how we do it around here too.
Oh, really? That makes me feel a little bit better, because there's some people with such big systems. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm completely inefficient, but whatever. I think that's okay.
Yeah, the important ones pop up.
Right. It allows it to stew with all the other stuff in your brain.
Yes. Yeah. I think that makes it even more organic. And so you get the best quotes at the best time.
Well, Kyle, this has been a fascinating discussion. Where can people learn more about your work?
Sure. Startupbros.com. And especially if they're interested in everything that we've been talking today, probably just Googling Art of Manliness Kyle will get them the three articles that we really dug into today.
Fantastic. Well, Kyle Eschenroeder, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Brett.
My guest today was Kyle Eschenroeder. He's the co-founder and co-owner of the company Startup Bros, where they train individuals how to start their own online business. For more information about his work, you can find that at startupbros.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you'd give us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends about us. Thank you for all your support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.